Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. The following program has been pre-recorded at Culture Fest last Wednesday the 14th at the Meadowlands Exposition Center. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Chaim Schmidt from the Culture Scene. This evening, we have the honor, the pleasure of interviewing Menachem Lubinsky, the one who started Kosher Scene 30 years ago. There have been many, many great marketers. Not a single one of them, or even all of them together, have accomplished what Menachem Lubinsky has accomplished all by himself. He took an industry that was dormant at best and brought it into the 21st century. He made it the fastest growing industry, the fastest growing trends in international food today. Good evening, Menachem.
Good evening. Well, this is the 30th year of Kosher Fest. And I know your listeners will be interested to know how this idea came about.
Absolutely.
And how it started. I went into business back in 1984. About 3 years later, a gentleman came to me who wanted to do a kosher food and Jewish life show and asked me to market it for him. So I did. And it was at the Javits Center, and 50,000 people came to that show.
I remember that show.
And it was a show that had everything in it, food, Judaica, services. And the show eventually traveled to different states, Chicago, L.A., Miami. And then this gentleman, Irving Silverman, who at that time was legally blind and he was sort of half deaf. He's still alive today at 98 years old. Asked me to buy the show, which I did, but I realized that the opportunity was not at a consumer show, but the opportunity was to begin to coalesce the people that were in the kosher space into a real industry. Because what we had was we had the Coca-Colas of the world who were kosher, and then the mom pops, but it was hardly an industry. There was no data. There was no information. And I realized that if I was going to develop this industry, it would have to be a legitimate trade show, and I would have to develop data. As it happened back in 1988, there was a company that was actually on the market and had hired the Smith Barney investment firm, and they did some data on the kosher market, the first data that ever. And from that point, I began to accumulate information and data on the kosher food industry. And in 1989, I turned this show into the trade show, which started with 69 booths and less than 500 visitors. Fast forward to today, we have close to 440 booths and over 7,000 visitors from 21 countries. But the store.
Apparently, the only reason you don't have more than 7,000 is because there's hardly any room to move, as
right. It is. There's hardly any room, and the focus is on trade, as it should be. And the bottom line is that this was an industry that went through a revolution, a complete revolution, from an old kind of post-European look to what it is today, which is a major category within the food industry. It's a $12.5 billion industry today. There are 18,000 supermarkets today that have some sort of kosher section. There are the discount chains, the Costco's of the world, the Trader Joe's, the Walmart's have all bought into this. And in the last 10 years, the last 12 years, we've had the development of the kosher independent stores. The gourmet glots, the seasons, the evergreens, the pomegranates, which created an opportunity for more and more products to be on shelves for the core kosher consumer. And this show developed alongside it, becoming as big as it is, and became the showcase for this industry, this evolving industry.
An interesting thing is, aside from Jews, I also saw quite a few non-Jews, including a few Muslims. it is interesting that everybody is suddenly interested in the kosher industry. What is the reason?
Well, there are a few reasons for that. The first reason is as you know, Muslims do not eat pork. And if they are not near... If they're not near a halal store, they're most likely to buy kosher products in a kosher supermarket. Then kosher has a panache of being better, being healthier. There is a recognition that kosher today is producing excellent quality products. It's not what it was, where everything was in cellophane and everything was in inferior. Products today in kosher are top of the line in every respect. In fact, I think one of the big changes that I've noticed at this show is the number of upscale products, the number of products that are moving into the health aspect, the interest by millennials in health, which we never thought was going to happen. We thought it was an older generation phenomenon. The convenience foods, people are very much interested in stuff that's pre-cooked, that they can drop into a microwave, into an oven. The exotic, you have here from 21 countries. I'm sitting right here, countries like the Philippines, the United Arab Emirates, Sri Lanka, Korea, Philippines. Countries that you would never think would be at a kosher show are here. So this is all part of this major revolution that took place, and it's called kosher, and the showcase is Kosher Fest.
An interesting thing is, over the years, there have been Argentinian pavilions with various articles. As a South American myself from Uruguay, I always appreciated whatever kosher items we could get. All of a sudden now there is a revolution. Many items that we never dreamt of when I grew up in South America, all of a sudden are made in South America strictly kosher. Not only is it a market that appeals to the Jews, but there is the... People have the conception that obviously if it's kosher, it must be healthier. Obviously, it must be purer. And yes, that helps. People want healthier, more pure foods. For example, with wines. And we have an explosion of kosher wines throughout the world. I see that a lot of kosher wines happen to win top awards competing against non-kosher wines. In other words, they are great wines that just happen to be kosher. I remember 34 years ago, the joke used to be, you want kosher wine? Take any wine, throw out half the bottle, fill it up with sugar, mix it well, kosher wine. All of a sudden, we are recognized around the world as the top of the top.
Well, that's very true. I mean, if you're talking about kosher wine, kosher wines has gone from being to a couple of sweet, what I call sacramental wines,
or extra, extra sweet,
to every type of wine that can be made kosher is made kosher. I mean, right here at the show, there are several exhibitors here who have 250, 300 different wines from countries all over the world, led by, and I have to give them their due, by Kerem, who was the major educator of kosher wine.
Wine, yes.
Yeah. So, I'm sorry. Who would have believed that Australia and Spain and countries that are known for their wines, Romania, that are known for their wines, are now making kosher because they recognize, number one, that they have a market in the U.S. But remember, there's also a kosher market called Israel. So when somebody manufactures a kosher product and he looks at those two markets and then looks at the periphery, Europe, Australia, South America.
Absolutely.
So this is not a small market by any stretch of the imagination. And the quality of the products that have been produced is really the story of the kosher food industry.
As a South American, kosher wine, wines in general, the big thing in Uruguay, where I came from, was Argentinian Malbec, which was considered like nobody could produce a Malbec like that. Yet the Israelis have managed not only to equal the Argentinian Malbec, but to actually be better than. I have tasted a few Malbecs over here. Incredible taste. As much as I love the Argentinian Malbecs, these guys are far superior.
Well, I think Malbec is just one example of the upscale wines that that the Americans today are able to taste. But if you talk about Israel, what Israel has done with wine to become a major producer with award-winning wines in every respect, whether it's from the Golan or it's from Hebron or it's from the Galil, it doesn't matter. They are excellent grape growers because of the climate, and they are also excellent winemakers. They have some of the best winemakers in the world. So, yeah, part of the kosher food revolution has been the kosher wine revolution.
Aside from the kosher wine, what are some of the reasons why kosher is suddenly the trend throughout the country?
Well, I think, first of all, supermarkets recognize that the kosher consumer is a good consumer to have. They're very loyal. And remember, if you provide them with the kosher products, bakery, meats, they'll shop the rest of the store. So it's not easy to get a customer who is loyal, stays with you, has 52 holidays before they have the first holiday, buy every week just as if it were a holiday. You know, in the non-Jewish world, there's Easter, Christmas, and Thanksgiving, and you're basically done. With us, we have 52 Shabbosim before we have the first Yontif. So this is not a bad customer to cultivate. I know from our studies, the average American spends about $7,000 a year in food with a family of four. The average Orthodox family with the same type of family spends over $21,000. Entertains more, buys more. So it's definitely, from a financial point of view, it's certainly very worthwhile to have this customer.
Not only that, but a few years ago, you told me about this particular product that could not possibly be kosher, and yet you walked into a show in Texas where you saw an OU on a product that was pork rind. And when you asked them, could it be used for anything other than pork rind, they said, absolutely not. And the reason they wanted the OU was because they get better shelf space. It pays to be kosher.
Most supermarket buyers in large cities, when they buy, will look for a kosher certified product, because what that does, it helps them reach out to the kosher market, but it doesn't necessarily reduce their chances of selling in the non-kosher market. So there's added value to the kosher certification symbol, which is exactly why they do it.
Now, what exactly caused a nice Jewish boy to suddenly become a marketer for kosher food? What exactly was the reasoning that went behind it? What exactly was the act that completed your life's work?
Well, I always had a passion for marketing, and in fact, I got my BA and my master's in marketing. I worked for 13 years as the right-hand person of one of the real heroes of the Jewish people, Rabbi Moshe Scherer, Zatzal. He taught me a lot. I traveled to Washington once a week. I did all the public relations, and I recognized that marketing was really my passion and decided to go out and open a firm in marketing. And I've always been very strategic in my outlook on things. And when I sit with a client, I ask more questions than I answer. Where do you want to be? What's your product? I need to know the DNA of a company before I can really give advice. Because with marketing, you can throw away a lot of bad money after bad money unless you know what you're doing. And I feel very bad when I see people throw money away without any strategic long-term plan of how to recoup that money.
Where do you see the kosher industry going from here?
Well, I think it's only going to get bigger, much bigger. I think the internet is playing a major role, because now the manufacturers can go directly into the homes of their consumers, which they were not able to do till now. They relied on the middleman. They relied on the retailer. I think the variety of products is going to be much more. When you say, well, what else can they produce? Every year they produce 500 new items that we never thought about. So it's just going to continue at that level. I think there's going to be more and more online relationships. In other words, people may not shop online, but they may order online and pick up online. So the world is changing. Technology is really changing the world.
Of course, for example, instead of advertising the traditional way, a lot of advertising today, almost free advertising, is through word of mouth, or rather through social media, where somebody will pick up a product he, she likes and will rave about it, and others will see it. So the whole industry is completely different. If you take a look at the 1950s, the marketing of the 1950s, the marketing of today, it's a different creature. It's not the same. What worked then is useless today, and so on.
Well, the interesting thing is that while the world has moved towards technology, we, in a sense, those of us who are Orthodox, have stayed behind. Because shoppers have turned off our smartphones, and so we have to read. So hence for the success of the magazines. And those magazines have bought into kosher big time. Every one of them has a section every week on food. Today we don't have any more cooks. We don't have a mother to daughter passing down cooks. We have kosher chefs. Every woman is into food preparation, meal ideas, designing the table. They become chefs and not just cooks.
Quite a few bloggers have become cookbook authors. Quite a few bloggers have not just become cookbook authors, but, as you said, superb chefs. For example, Levana from the old Levana's restaurant. Although she may never have trained as a chef, she is, in her very own right, one of the top kosher chefs in the world. And so there are quite a few others. What else do
you need? Yeah, I think, just think about it. When Kosher Fest first started 30 years ago, if you would walk into a Jewish bookstore, you'd find maybe a dozen kosher cookbooks. Today there are about 140 of them. And you walk into a household today and you'll find a whole bookcase just of kosher cookbooks. So the kosher consumer has not just become a consumer, they become an active player in the kosher world. They're taking kosher products to enhance their lives, to make their lives better, to make the experience of their families. Dinner is no longer just dinner. Dinner is an experience.
Absolutely. Not only that, but if you take a look at the different varieties of kosher bookstores, of kosher books, cookbooks, it's not just, you know, the Heimische cooking, the brisket, the roast beef, but we are into international cuisine, Japanese cuisine, Korean cuisine, Vietnamese cuisine, and so on and so forth. And I even heard of some Sudanese kosher cuisine, which was very surprising. We're expanding into everything. The fact that there are so many Balei Tshuvas who have experienced all that which those of us who were born into the kosher world never knew, they are exposing us to all these new things, all these experiences that we never dreamt of.
Well, you know, I think the best story I can tell you is that I met a young lady here who has 7 children, and she has every night, she has a different theme night for dinner. Mediterranean night. She just did a Vietnamese food night. The only night that everyone would recognize would be Thursday night. She has pizza night. But aside from that, she made life interesting, and she doesn't tell them in advance. She plans for it. So, food, kosher food, has not just become something that you have to eat, but something you can enjoy and have a participant in that whole experience. So it's been a revolution, exactly as I said.
I remember growing up in Montevideo, so there were two things that we used to do every week. My mother and I would go down to the center, where there was a big, once a week, big kosher market. Sometimes it was outdoors, sometimes it was indoors, but that was our experience. And of course we had the deli, or the fiambreria, as we used to call it, in the corner. wine, there were two wines. My father, Olav Shalom, we used to make this extra, extra sweet 21% wine, which I grew up with. Today, if I were to drink it, I would kill over. And for a Pesach, we used to get this other company called Sara Rosa, special for Pesach. During the year, their name was Santa Rosa, Saint Rose. I guess that was not a very kosher name, so they changed it to Sara Rosa. That was about it, the experience of kosher food in Uruguay. When I came to the States, all I knew about kosher wines was this extra, extra sweet Malaga or whatever, which today is totally undrinkable. And thanks to the likes of Levana in her restaurant, we discovered that there is such a thing as kosher dry wine from France and other countries. And yes, the revolution exploded. But tell me, where do you think it's going from here?
Well, as I pointed out before, and I think it's very much in evidence here, more new products, more uses of products, more variations of products, more convenience food, same items, much healthier, low carbs, high protein in a way. It's going in the direction. We used to be 10, 20 years behind the general food industry. Today, we're just right there. I mean, we are producing everything almost that the non-kosher world is producing and more.
You mentioned before that today the kosher industry is over a $21 billion industry. Where was it when you started with the show 30 years ago?
Well, it's about a $12.5 billion industry. I don't know because we had a very hard time getting data, but I'm going to assume that I had like 10% of what it is today.
Now, up until now, we have heard about Menachem Lubinsky, the master marketer, the legendary kosher marketer. But there is another aspect. Yes, marketing is how he makes his living, but he does it with passion, he does it with love. But there is also another aspect, the human aspect. The person who fights to conserve, to keep up with the Jewish traditions, to keep up with Jewish history, hard as they seem, would not be what it is today were it not for the efforts, for the fight, for the tears, for the screams that Menachem Lubinsky and his brother put up. Can you please tell us a little bit about it?
Well, Har HaZeisim, or Mount of Olives, which directly is across from the Har HaBayis and was the place that really served the Har HaBayis. The Kahanim got dressed there. The ashes of the Parah Aduma were put there. If anyone came up to Yerushalayim and needed a Korban Pesach, the mall was on Har HaZeisim. Its holiness is established by the Rambam as being equal to the Har HaBayis. When it became a cemetery, and the estimate is that somewhere about 2,000 years ago was when, or 2,500 years ago, because the Nevi'im are buried there, Zechariah is buried there, Haggai, Hilda Nevi'ah is buried there. What happened was, when it came under Jordanian control, there were about 230,000 graves there. And the Jordanians completely destroyed it, used a lot of graves for latrines even, and building roads, and built a hotel, totally abused it. And in 1967, when the Israelis recaptured it, of course it was now under Jewish control, but they did nothing to upgrade the cemetery, to restore what was destroyed, to rebuild. And in fact, because it's in a neighborhood in East Jerusalem, surrounded by Arabs, the Arabs used it as a place to store construction material. They used it as a place to play soccer games. There was a place where donkeys were found dead from the heat. It was the center of the drug trade in Yerushalayim. They were building housing. Slowly but surely, they had a vision of building on top of the graves. It happens to be my parents were buried there. And when the state controller came out with a report in 2010, about the abuse and the desecration of Har HaZeisim, my brother and I decided that we had to do something, even though we were in Brooklyn, New York, and not in Jerusalem. We called together a meeting of all the Jewish organizations, and I met together with Malcolm Hohenlein, with Prime Minister Netanyahu, who opened all the doors for us. I went back to Israel. Things started to happen. Eventually, we were able to put a police station back on Har HaZeisim. We put up 173 cameras. We put up fencing. We began to restore the broken graves. We brought a unit of the border police there. It was, what we were doing was, I think the biggest thing was, and I spoke to Arabs in the area, which I do, they for the first time were able to understand that we're not leaving, which is what they thought. They have the impression, and I think people have to understand that, they have the impression that Jews like luxury, they like comfort, and that eventually they get tired. This is the way the Arabs think of us as Jews. And here in Har HaZeisim, they thought the same thing. It's a bunch of graves. Why should they care? It's not live people. It's dead people. And their feeling was that eventually we would just walk away from it. Not to speak of the fact that we figured out there were about 9,000 Americans buried on Har HaZeisim. French Jews, other Jews. Aside from all the Gedolim that are buried in Har HaZeisim. My friend told me he went to Tzvas and Tveria. He visited 11 holy graves. He went to Har HaZeisim. He visited 450 holy graves of Tzaddikim. So we caused a major change there. Today, Har HaZeisim is safe. You can go there without any escort, without any armed escort, freely. We even have lighting now at night for people who want to come at night. Very bright. We put in new circular cameras. And we're not finished. We're going to build a visitor center there that people will be able to learn a lot about the history of it. Just now, the cable car is being finished. There'll be a cable car that'll go from the center of the city to the Kotel, Kosel Maravi, and then over to Har HaZeisim. Bottom line is, what Eliot Olmert wanted to turn over to the Saudis and to the Jordanians to be an international force to police it, it's not going to happen. As the Prime Minister said to me very, very clearly, he said, I cannot think of any person in this country today who would turn over Har HaZeisim as part of a negotiating chip. So, thankfully, and you know, the bottom line is, I said this story last night, Rudy Giuliani had this ongoing argument whether New York is policeable, whether you can police New York. The fellow Chico Moshe Edry, who was the commander of the police in Jerusalem, last week became the commissioner of police in Israel, said to me, you guys gave us the courage to know that we can police this, that we can secure it, and we can also control East Jerusalem.
In 1967, when I was a volunteer for the Six-Day War, I remember the Kotel was completely surrounded by Arab latrines. The stench was unbearable. The flies were about a million flies per person. I remember when I left Eretz Israel in 77 to come back to the States. We went through Har HaZeisim, and Har HaZeisim certainly is not what it looks like today. It was a dangerous zone, not too far from the Intercontinental Hotel, which I believe was still owned by Arabs at the time. Unless you went in a group, you didn't dare go there. And today, Baruch Hashem, the whole situation changed. Partially, we can blame our politicians of the past, and we can thank for today's situation people like you, your brother, and others.
Thank you. You know, my rebbes are buried there. I'm a Gerach Chassid. You know, then Beis Yisrael was, I grew up on the Beis Yisrael, so to me it's very special when I go there to visit the Mara, what they call it, of the rebbes. But I can tell you one thing. I can tell you that the bottom line is that there's no longer an atmosphere of fear. And we have on Har HaZeisim, you have the key. He has the key to the Mara. You know, okay. I can tell you that now when I go up, I always felt like my father was demanding something from me and my mother. And I have a feeling that they're saying thank you now instead of demanding.
It is impossible to visit Har HaZeisim without feeling that our ancestors are there waiting for us, without feeling that history is in front of our eyes. It is impossible to visit it without feeling emotional, even if you don't have anybody who's actually buried there.
You have 150,000 Neshamas who had no voice. We gave them a voice. Absolutely. And absolutely. And all I can say is, I think if people who go to Har HaZeisim today and recognize there's no place in the world where you can walk through 3,000 years of history. You can start from the Nevi'im, you can go up to Menachem Begin, who was buried in Har HaZeisim. So Har HaZeisim is the fundamental place, and that's what we're going to do in the visitor center. We're going to show the passage of history over the years. And you know, the most visited grave on Har HaZeisim is the Or HaChaim. Approximately 500,000 people a year visit the Or HaChaim's grave. Next to that would be Ger and Shvil. I mean, those are some of the more visited graves. But people come over to me and say, I couldn't go to the Or HaChaim's cave and I feel like a different person. I feel like my Yeshuas are around the corner. And thank you for helping us reach the Yeshuas. All right.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lubinsky. As always, it's been very educational. As always, it's been very enlightening. And thank you for revealing another personality besides the legendary marketer. Good night, ladies and gentlemen. Tune us in again next Thursday evening. Good night, one and all.